Elkin was eager to go. He had apparently been on house arrest, or something, after his inquiry began, and was visibly excited by the prospect of seeing the snow that never melted in person. He greeted me warmly.
"I knew they would let you keep it after they met you,"
he assured me, nodding at the witch sphere as he fingered his chin.
"They're just worried about misuse, and you're the most level-headed human I've ever met. And to think that was just the start of your journeys,"
he chuckled, his bell-like laughter lifting my spirits. "I'm looking forward to getting into the mysteries you've created. I hope you don't mind working with Karshank," I said hesitantly. I know some Alka-Alon had issues with their cousins.
"No, no, I love the Karshank,"
he assured. "Great craftsmen in their way, and far underappreciated.
I heard you were working with a stone singer."
"Master Guri," I said. He nodded.
"A good choice. A distinguished house,"
he approved. "I think you'll like Sevendor," I smiled. "It has a lot of charm, and a lot of potential."
"Just the thing I am looking for,"
he said. "They do have wine there, do they not?" I don't know why, but the innocent question gave me pause. There was just something in the way he said it that seemed foreboding. When we arrived through the waypoint atop Les Gaethiel, mid-morning, the sun was shining brightly on both the spire overhead and the mountain in the distance. You could see the Karshak scaffolding from here now. The vegetable gardens of the Tal Alon spread out below us and melded into fields of ripening wheat, oats, potatoes, and barley. The summer mowing was in full swing, requiring reluctant peasants to labor at the backbreaking work every hour of daylight, and the scent of fresh-cut grasses filled the air.
"How lovely,"
Onranyan said, after a few moments' consideration.
"That's a handsome tower,"
he remarked, looking up at the spire of Les Gaethiel.
"I can feel the effects of the stone already." "The whole tower is made from it,"
explained Guri with pride. "We used a series of static arches on the—"
"Master Onranyan,"
Italia said, and triggered her transgenic enchantment. In moments, she was standing in front of me as the Alkan equivalent of a beautiful young woman in a very close-fitting gown of green and brown.
"Perhaps you should change. Our original form proves distracting to the natives, and the tal at the foot of the mountain will not give you a moment of peace in your true form."
To emphasize this, Ladies Varen and Thalawen both transformed into shapely young human-style women wearing tightly fitted gowns in a forest motif.
"Oh, yeah," Dara snorted. "That won't be distracting at all."
"It does keep your neck from hurting from looking up all the time," I agreed.
"Oh, of course," the old sorcerer laughed. "Transgenics, how delightful. Go ahead, little one,"
he said, nodding toward Italia. She sang a song, the Alkan equivalent of a mnemonic, and Master Onranyan's tiny body grew in size and changed in form as the notes formed. Soon he stood before us, an older man, tall, with dark hair, graying ever so slightly at the temples in front of his ever so slightly pointed ears. He was also completely naked. I don't know if it was the nature of the enchantment or Oranian's native essence, but I had a feeling he would prove extremely popular with the ladies of Sevendor, if allowed to indulge in interspecies relations. Apparently, garments were not part of the original enchantment.
"We'll find you some clothes,"
Thalawen assured him, quickly, once she realized the problem.
"Clothes? Yes. I'm looking forward to that."
"And look at that! A pendulous penis!"
he said, childlike in his glee.
"How novel!"
"There are other differences,"
Italia said, blushing. "Greater physical strength, for one, higher center of gravity, and, of course, the difference in perceptions. Nor will the transformation be as difficult in the future. The first time is always the most challenging."
"My dear, I count myself completely satisfied." "Well then, Master Spellmonger,"
the naked Alkan asked me conversationally, "show me to this mountain of yours."
"In due time, Master Oranyan,"
Lady Varen said soothingly,
"the Mage Lord has duties to attend to, and we must instruct you in their ways before you go forth among them. The mountain will still be there. Trust me, Master, we have spent weeks here learning their ways.
At least I can see it from here, and I suppose this tower has enough of the substance to give me a place to begin my research, she said, looking up at it, hopefully. And I can go tell Alia I'm back. She's due any day now. Pentandra, would you like to stay a few days? I asked, hopefully.
As pleasant as it sounds, I have duties to attend to at the capital, she assured me. I would not want to inconvenience our emissaries.
That was her polite way of saying, your former lover doesn't really need to be around your happy family during such an intimate time. But I was too dense or scared to realize it. Alia's first birth had been eventful. I was worried about the second. But while Pentandra knew more than any human being alive about conception, she knew next to nothing about its results. I'd be better off with a village midwife, I realized.
We are here to assist you,
Italia said eagerly. We can transport you later as easily as now. We have been given permission to use the waypoints at will now. See? Nothing to stop you lingering a few days. Besides, we need to discuss what all happened at the council with everyone else, including the king. Don't forget this stuff, Dara said from behind us. I turned. What stuff? The big old chest I've been carrying? Isn't it yours?
I don't. The gift from the council,
Pentandra said excitedly.
What is it, I wonder?
Master Minolin should open it, Dara said suspiciously, backing away warily after she set the smooth wooden cask on the ground. I didn't think they would make good on their pledge so quickly, I said, startled.
The council can take centuries to study something before it acts, explained Oranian. But once it makes up its mind, it acts swiftly.
Is that how my voice sounds now? He asked in wonder. I moved toward the chest, nearly 2 feet wide and a foot deep. It was stunning, of Alka-Alon manufacture and decorated with gracefully curving leaves carved in the lid. I put my hand on it, held my breath and opened it. The glimmer of hundreds of witchstones of all shapes and sizes sparkled before me. Enough for an army of high magi. Chapter 6 A Trove of Witchstones. The sea of Irianite swam in front of me, and a wave of magical energy washed over me. I gasped, and then couldn't breathe. We had hoped for help from the Alka-Alon, and hoped for witchstones, but this was far, far more than I had ever dreamed they would grant us.
Oh, dear gods, preserve us, Pentandra whispered.
How many? Demanded Master Guri. How many are your waystones worth? The Karshak have an obsession about value and worth, the way that Alka-Alon obsessed about trees. So we sat there under the spire of Lesgathiel and counted them, like children playing marbles. There were exactly, we discovered, 200 witchstones in that chest. It made the Alka-Alon coronation gift look miserly in comparison. None of the shards was over half an inch, and some were shaded differently, but they were all potent stones, stones that had never felt the touch of the dead god.
200 new high magi, I swallowed. That's more than we have now. That effectively more than doubles your eventual constituency, agreed Pentandra excitedly.
If I can find 200 worthy magi, I grumbled.
That will be a problem, Penny agreed, and it puts you in an interesting situation. You'll be creating a whole new magical nobility.
Well, I'm not going to hand them all out at once, I decided, but this does give us a significant advantage on the field.
And in court, Penny reminded me.
With nearly 400 high magi running around, that makes you far more important.
That's real political power, Min.
Closer to 300 than 4. I don't want real political power, I griped.
But you'll need it if you want to get anything done, she pointed out. Like build castles and destroy evil goblin heads. Min, this is exactly what you asked for.
And more, Ithalia agreed.
Not only are we permitted to continue in these transformed bodies, she said, gesturing to her breathtaking form, but it is permitted for others to do so as well. And we have been allowed to assist in other ways.
What other ways?
There is a project that the others and I have been considering for a few months now, based on our acquaintance with your domain, Mage Lord, in particular concerning the little flyer your apprentice keeps." She went on to describe her proposal in detail, occasionally lapsing into technical jargon or using Alcan words where there were no human ones, but I could immediately see the utility of her plan. I swallowed. "And that's just the beginning," she said happily. "We can begin to work together much more closely. Already the Council is assembling a team to study the origin of Snowstone and see if it can be recreated. Master Oranyan is but the first of many great spellsingers to journey here and put the question to mind." "Better," Lady Varen said, a faint smile on her thin lips. "A band of sympathizers wishes to undertake transgenic transformation into humani forms and fight by your side. Refuges across the wilderlands will be opened to your agents. Humani and Alon will work together for the first time in centuries. This is a very exciting time." It was a lot to take in, but it was help, all the help I had asked for, and more than I had hoped for. "Of course, there will be some conditions on that assistance," Ithalia began.
200 Witchstones. After tracking down Alia and telling her I was home, and then relating what happened at Carnaduin, I had her and Penny, Bannermoor and Olmeg, Dara and Sir Festeran in my workshop to discuss the matter. Even Master Guri had returned to his lodge to report. It was the first time I had been in a humans-only situation in 3 days, and we had a lot to discuss.
200, Bannermoor said, dazed. "That's a lot of high magi."
"It won't be as exclusive a club when it's done," I agreed, "but that doesn't make it a bad thing. But we must keep this secret from the Royal Court and the Arcane Orders. If it was known, there would be no way to go about our business without being hounded by the ambitious."
"No one actually knows just how many witchstones there are, except us,"
Pentandra pointed out as Bannermoor poured her glass full.
"They come through Minnellan, but no one but he knows how many are in the open. He can just continue to hand them out, quietly."
"And make a fortune every time he does,"
Bannermoor said sourly.
"So what if he does?" asked Alia. "Fortunes must be spent after they're gathered. What's the harm to you?"
"Competition," Bannermoor shot back.
"Allies," I corrected. "Political and military. And a market for your trinkets," I reminded him. "You've seen the kind of magic you can do with a witchstone? You need equipment for a lot of that. Speaking of which, did they arrive?"
"Yesterday,"
he sighed in agreement. 9 of them, just in from Sendaria Port. They all worked as promised, and so I paid the men. I spent all night testing them. I was taking a nap when you summoned me," he said accusingly.
"What?"
asked Pentandra. "A gift to the kingdom from the Arcane Orders," I told her, then described the scheme Bannermoor and I had kicked up one memorable night. Pentandra's eyes got bigger and bigger.
"You thought of that all by yourself?"
she asked in disbelief.
"I was there," Bannermoor objected. "I helped."
"It wasn't hard," I protested. "I've seen them do that sort of thing at sea, and I thought a similar system would work with these."
"You object?"
"No, I think it's a great idea.
But that doesn't mean it isn't problematic, too."
"I know," I assured her. "We thought a whole lot of ways it could be used, but most of them were good."
"It will help,"
she admitted, "and it's impressive as hell. Not to mention useful and practical and a boon to our security. Not to mention a crafty application of the enchantment. It's just that..."
"What?" I demanded.
"I just don't know how you thought about it without me," she said simply.
"I know," Alia agreed, patting her tummy. "It's just not like him."
"Hey, I give credit to other people for their work when I steal it. I just happened to think this up on my own. Most importantly, Rard will love it. It saves him a lot of time, trouble, and money. Kings like that sort of thing. And it makes the Order suddenly very important to the kingdom in a way that doesn't involve mage blades," Bannermoor agreed. "I like that kind of institutional stability."
"It's not going to keep Rard from noticing that there are an awful lot of high magi around," Pentandra promised. "He's not stupid. You can allude to some future help the Alka Alon will give us all you want, But eventually he's going to realize that there are far more high magi around than the war can account for. That leaves the Alka alone, she pointed out, and he will not be happy that you cut a deal with them.
I took advantage of a strategic resource, I corrected. I couldn't use the Waystones myself anyway. I don't know the spells, yet. But the Alka alone loved them, and we got what we needed. Rard doesn't need to know the details of the exchange until he does.
He won't care until he does, is what you mean? Alia pointed out. That many high magi are going to cause problems, even if you do it slowly.
Penny wasn't wrong. I had a list of candidates for witch stones that seemed to go on for miles, with more suggestions coming in all the time. Now that I had a wealth of them, I could sate some of the pressures that had built up for them. Even better, my goodly supply allowed me more leeway and thoughtfulness about just who should be given priority on the list. That was an exercise of power I could enjoy. I didn't have to make any decisions quickly, thankfully. I had until the conclave, in early summer, to figure out where I could place stones that would do the most good. But what was the most good? That wasn't particularly clear anymore, and I needed it to be. The war effort certainly needed attention. There were 20 war magi who could do great work in the field, if they had stones. But then the special orders, enchanters, magical medicine, and other specialists were grumbling about the rarity of witch stones in their circles, and I knew that they could do some real good. Then there were the academic magi who were near demanding more Irionite to further their research. Prosperous spellmongers and well-established resident adepts were ready to pay great sums for the stones, and I had made a practice of giving a few to poor foot wizards, just to keep things fair. There were politically wise grants I could make, bringing whole families of magi into my influence, and there were those I wanted to keep stones away from. But every stone I took an oath for was another marble on the board, another player in the game. Another high mage to be policed and regulated. And regulation needed some attention. And soon. There were a handful of magi I wanted to reward at once, and as soon as I could, I sent messages to the appropriate places, and waited for them to show up. There was little logic in some of the grants, but I didn't mind indulging in a little honest graft after what I had accomplished. I quietly handed out about 10 stones in the next few weeks. Dexter Dot of Herring and Timian of Lister were good examples. Neither one of them were particularly gifted or talented, but they had both attended the academy with me. It hadn't taken Iyugi, my foot wizard turned spy, long at all to track them down. Timian had avoided the draft and gone on to become a spellmonger in his own right, down toward the coast, and Dex had married and become the court mage of a small barony in the southern riverlands after his tour in Faerice. Both were shocked and surprised at the summons, but they came nearly at the same time. We had a lovely little reunion on top of my tower, drinking my wine and catching up. They were both amazed and appalled that I had done so well. I admit I enjoyed showing off for them. None of us had thought we'd ever amount to much. When I gave them their stones, I made them both wealthy men. While nepotism played a role, of course, it was also an experiment. I wanted to test, to see if a high mage could benefit his community without conquering it. I sent them back home after acclimatizing them to their stones and showing them a few things. I vowed to check up on them to see how they fared. One mage I raised almost at once was Master Andelnum, a competent enchanter from nearby Sindaria town. He and his four daughters had been great friends and allies to Sevendor, particularly in the procurement and construction of magical components. He worked closely with Bannermore, too, acting as an agent at port for us at need. He had been instrumental in building my present to King Rard. There was no compelling reason to grant him a stone, save that he had been of service to us, and I found that sufficient. He was just as surprised as Dex and Timian had been, and just as suddenly rich. My discussion with Ithalia about security made me paranoid. I had the stones moved, along with the exotic crystals Master Guri had harvested, inside a hidden cave behind a kennel in the Westwood. Only a few people even knew the place existed, and I had put powerful warding spells on it. It was as safe as I could imagine, but I still woke up chilled at the thought of someone stealing it. That was an issue, because a few weeks earlier someone tried to steal Tyndall's Witchstone while he was at Inarian Academy. An agent of the criminal gang known as the Brotherhood of the Rat had drugged Tyndall and stolen it briefly, but he had recovered it with Rondal's help. That was worrisome. The Brotherhood was a criminal organization that occasionally dabbled in politics, but if they were looking for witchstones, I'd have to take note of them. I couldn't imagine they wanted them for peaceful purposes. That didn't suit their reputation. Knowing who I didn't want to have Irionite was easy, but I had to place at least some of these damned stones now, and that was hard. Of course, finding good war magi for the war effort was a top priority. There was almost always a few of these candidates around Seven Door Town. In the past, I'd made it a requirement that the war magi I granted stones to were to submit to a kind of examination, which mostly required them to hang around and do what I told them to while I watched their character. Unless a candidate was thoroughly vouched for, I was uneasy about putting a stone in the hands of a man I didn't know personally. That wasn't just paranoia. It takes a special kind of person to be a war mage. Some of the most successful were also the ones I least wanted to empower. Genuine sadists, men without conscience or lacking in character, might have been geniuses on the field, but I had to deal with them off the field too. I didn't expect every mage who picked up Irionite to be noble in spirit, but I didn't want to create my own disasters either. Mostly, I had good candidates. There were a lot more magi from the east in town now, as word of the Witchstones had spread, and the allure of arcane power drew them to Sevendor. I picked the best ones I could, regardless of nationality. I even granted stones to several Merwini and Voreans that spring. The grant was conditional on enlisting immediately in the war effort. We were expecting some sort of advance in strength down the timber road into ravaged Gilmora any day now, and I wanted to be prepared to meet that advance robustly. I was proud of the vicious killers and cunning defenders I sent out, and my commander in the field, Telemann, was pleased with the recruitment drive. He was garrisoning small castles and manors throughout southern Gilmora, and even considering setting up some advanced bases inside enemy territory in preparation for the inevitable attack. Large castle garrisons, as we had found out, tended to concentrate our strength, but they also made a tempting target for dragons. Dragons might be difficult to control, but if you can get one to fly to the vicinity of a castle swarming with soldiers, it doesn't take much control to let it devour and destroy the place. These new war magi were part of the effort to seed the expected invasion route with tough killers, to bolster the mundane soldiers clustered there. After a devastating winter of raids and surprise attacks, there weren't many people left in northern Gilmora. Much of the population had fled the invasion, while all too many were led away from the front in shackles, marched north into shadow, destined for slavery and sacrifice. The defenses were getting more organized now. Lords, whose houses hadn't seen real battle in two generations, had opened their armories and armed Gilmora's plentiful peasantry. Lances that had only been used in tournaments were stained with Gervani blood. Our defeat of an army and a dragon at Cambrian Castle had been a turning point. From thence, the folk of Gilmora had stopped running in terror and had begun to see to their own defense. Nor was King Rard idle at the threat to his most populous and prosperous regions. Using his new powers liberally, he had called upon vassals for service at once at his coronation, and some of those vassals were beginning to respond. It is difficult to raise a great army in a feudal government, but now there were households of knights and companies of archers based in southern Gilmora that would make taking it difficult for the Gavani. And within many of those castles, there were now high magi fortifying the walls with defensive spells, preparing contingencies for attack and otherwise coordinating defenses. My newfound wealth in Irionite meant I could speed up that process. I began requesting two candidates at a time, and found that helpful as I could play them off in competition with each other. I needed that, as I had lost the advantage of a local enemy I could try them against. Sire Gimble, the warbird of Westflaria, may have been a lousy neighbor, but he made an excellent pell against which my war magi could practice. Sire Gimbal's brother, Vulric, the Baron of Flaria, was hardly better, but he had stayed out of my affairs. The Lord of Sashtalia likewise had been quiet since the Warbird's defeat. So I gave them competitions against each other, and I got a lot of free work done. Most of the candidates were patient, well-disciplined men, and a few women, who knew their craft and appreciated the testing, rather than resented it. A few were exceptional. Lorcus of Mekana was from a small fief in eastern Rhemir, near the frontier with Merwin. He'd been the youngest son of a petty noble and had secured admission to one of the eastern magical academies. He'd done a brief stint in the censorate, but left before taking his final vows. He was a court wizard for a few small baronies, but was forced to take up war magic during a siege and got a taste for it. He became a mercenary war mage and quickly developed a reputation for cunning. He had worked in Castal during the Frisian War, while most of our war magi were otherwise employed, and stayed because he liked the place. If there was a simple way to do something, Lorcus would ignore it in favor of the flamboyant and complicated. But his plans had interesting ways of achieving unanticipated results. He was a deep thinker, with a flamboyant style, always a stimulating combination. We'd worked together briefly once, back in my mercenary days, and I'd liked him. A few years older than me, Lorcus had an infectious personality and a deeply sarcastic wit, one that had gotten him into trouble more than once. He was a good 6 feet tall, had a dark brown hairline that was in full retreat, and favored a bushy mustache and shaven cheeks. His eyes. Mostly, they looked sane. But he could affect the look of a madman upon request, and I had no doubt when he was enraged it would be fearsome to behold. I took to Lorcus immediately. He was eager for the power of the stone, but that eagerness was tempered by at least a bit of humility. Lorcus approached it as a great honor, and after he saw what sorts of things we were doing in Sevendor, he appreciated that honor all the more. The war magi whom he'd been paired with, an uncreative Rhemiran who specialized in siege engines, lost each of the competitions I gave them, thanks to Lorcus' cleverness and keen observation. I sent them both into Sashtalia on a mission to spy on a small castle and report back. The Rhemiran gave a technically accurate report on the geography, architecture, and personnel, and outlined a reasonable plan for attacking the place, using 2 war magi, 2 scorpion crews, and a company of heavy infantry. Lorcus gave a reasonably accurate report on the layout and disposition of the castle, but when it came to how he recommended taking it, his approach was novel. "Set fire to the fulling shed," he advised. "And?" I asked expectantly. "Set fire to the fulling shed," he repeated. "The shed is near to the storehouse. Here," he said, pointing it out on the mage map he'd constructed. "That's where the real coin is for this estate. They wouldn't want to catch that on fire, so they'd form a bucket line from the well to here," he said, showing the direction. "Why wouldn't they pull from the castle cistern?" I asked, noting how much closer it was. "Because the cistern is cracked and empty," he replied smugly, something that my colleague failed to note. "The well in the bailey is the only source of water nearby, and when they formed that line, which every able-bodied man in the castle would be compelled to do with such a prize at risk, everyone would be in the outer bailey, nor would they be attentive to infiltrators. 1 man to lower the portcullis, 2 more to cover the entrance with crossbows. As they return from putting out the fire, they have to pass through this gate, and they can be disarmed with ease and captured without their fellows seeing them surrender." "That's... well, where do you use magic?" I wondered. The Rhemiran's plan required several spells to reduce the gatehouse. "Why use magic when you can use wits? His way leaves you with dead defenders, dead attackers, and a compromised castle. My way leaves you with a fully intact estate, few if any casualties, plenty of ransoms, and a slightly singed fulling shed. You didn't ask how I would use magic to assault the place. You asked me how I would take it. That's how I would take it." I liked Lorcus. He liked me as well, and lingered at Sevendor long after he'd gotten his stone. He was terribly charming to the ladies, and he was well respected among both my mundane warriors and my magical peers. He cultivated courtly manners even as he toured Seven Doors taverns and gambled with the lowliest villeins. Even Sire Kay liked him, which was a stroke in his favour. He was there the night Alia went into labour. I was a nervous wreck, despite having two birth sisters and a birth mother on hand, as well as one of Master Ikarod's medical apprentices, which cost me another witch stone. After what happened with Manalion's birth, I had no idea what to expect. Alia gave birth to my daughter, my second daughter, mid-morning, with hardly any difficulty, besides the brutality that is inherent to birth. I had nightmarish visions at least as bad as any horror of battle when the labor began. Lorcas kept me drunk and calm with a dozen fantastic stories to keep me distracted. It turned out I had nothing to worry about. Mother and daughter were healthy and well. There were no magical effects that we could detect at all, and I had a company of fascinated Alka Alon in the Great Hall, observant for such effects. She was a healthy baby girl, even larger than her brother had been. We named her Almina, and she had the most perfectly exquisite bright blue eyes I'd ever seen. Lorcas thought so too, and vowed to slay the first man who dared touch her. While I thought that was quite noble of him, it was hard to look down at the baby I held and even imagine her as a full-grown woman. Lorcas got attached to Sevendor. When at last it came time for him to fulfill his service in Gilmora for a month, as promised, he was reluctant and eager at the same time. Lorcas returned briefly that early summer, after doing a tour shoring up the Gilmoran defences. He bore several official dispatches from the front, but his assessment of the ground situation was what I found most helpful. "They're raiding and slaving, but they're not doing what I'd do if I was preparing to cross the river," he told me over dinner in my tower the night he arrived. "It's an organized looting operation. The camps they're making in the captured castles are temporary. Supply depots, not operational bases. They're guarded stoutly enough, as is the road north, but they are not fortifying them to hold them." "You don't think they'll continue the invasion this summer, then, when the road's fully dry?" He shook his head. "Nay, they'll use the time to drain Gilmora dry, and there is plenty yet to drain. But their aim is pillage, not conquest. At least not yet." "That's almost a relief," I sighed. "We aren't ready to repel a full-fledged invasion yet."
"That's the God's own truth,"
he agreed darkly. "There are men enough there. Hundreds of thousands, if you count peasants with spears. But the mercenary companies are responsible for protecting the cities. The local lords attempt to assert their authority at every turn, and there is little organization when it comes to deploying fresh levies from the south.
A massive refugee camp that has sprung up, south of Barabel. Worst sort of place. The temples are feeding them, with some assistance from the crown, but more arrive every day. So far, there is no one arming and training them."
"What about the royal army?" I asked. That had been one of King Rad's first institutions, a permanent royal army to act in defense of the kingdom. It was supposed to be the answer to such threats.
"There are three commando units under the king's banner who are scheduled to be deployed in Gilmora," he admitted. "Mercenaries and volunteers. Mostly professionals. They have charge of the defense of the region, in theory, over the whims of any local lord. Count Salgo commands them, but they are still forming. They won't be deployed until late summer, at the earliest."
"Then let us hope that the dead god is content with North Gilmora until we can get our act together. So, now that you've completed your first term, what are your plans?"
"I've given thought to conquering an estate and starting an empire. Seems to be all the fashion nowadays. Or heading east and make a fortune in coin, curing flagging desires in rich lords, and removing unsightly blemishes from the faces of wealthy and ever-so-grateful ladies. But that sounds incredibly boring," he yawned.
"If it's excitement you crave, you can always return to the front," I pointed out.
"Until there is a real advance, that's going to be more defensive spellwork. Likewise, boring. I was thinking something more interesting. Like what you're doing."
"What am I doing?" I asked, confused.
"You are doing everything," he pronounced, pouring more wine. "You are rewriting the rules of magic. You've toppled the bloody censors. You put a king on a bloody throne. If the rumors are true, you made the Alka Alon sit up and beg, and that pretty tower that looks so out of place on your horizon proves it. You made a whole bloody mountain turn magical. You've got that great whopping sphere of Irionite in your pocket and a legion of loyal followers. Then why do I feel like I'm doing such a shitty job? It's because you feel like you are doing a shitty job that proves you are the man for it, he advised. I wouldn't want the position if it was given to me. I don't have the temperament for it. But you do, he warned me. You think before you act, Spellmonger, and you think about more than your own welfare. I admire that. Enough to consider offering you my service. You want to take my service? As what? What do you need? He asked simply. Look, I pride myself on versatility. I'm a fair mage and a decent fighter, but what I do best is figure things out. You've given me the opportunity to do whatever I wish, he said, patting the silken bag around his neck that carried his stone. And what I wish is to figure things out, on your behalf. That's a generous offer, Lorcas, I agreed. You are a man of many talents, and I am desperate to find such men right now. But how do I know I can trust you? He shrugged. I don't know. What would it take to convince you? So I summoned a retainer of mine, Lysanna. She was a lovely young woman who was a magical sport, someone who had a marked strength in one area of their talent, but not enough to develop by study. Her particular gift was also a horrible curse. In her presence, you could not utter a falsehood. It had made her life miserable, and she had quietly made her way to Sevendor to seek my help, as so many did. Thankfully, I had figured out a way to dampen the effect with a classy little enchantment she now wore as a necklace. When she took it off, she was a truth-compeller, and she was in my employ and under my protection. That had proven exceptionally useful to me a few times. Her gift was a closely held secret in my household, but if I needed to know I could trust someone, I could call her in. She lived on a stipend I paid, in a small cottage on the South Ridge when she wasn't needed at the castle, but I had also given her an enchantment to let her know when I summoned her. I questioned Lorcas for 2 hours, and he utterly satisfied me as to his loyalties. I excused Lysanna with a generous tip before welcoming him into my inner circle. That's quite the lass you have there, he said, blushing once she'd left. She's helpful, I agreed. So, you want to work for me? I need good men. What is left is to decide in what capacity you should work. Well, what is your most pressing problem? That was a good question. Another reason why I liked Lorcas. Now that I had a wealth of stones, an untold fortune in Snowstone, lands, titles, and responsibilities, my most pressing problems were organizational. Why don't you go investigate Master Dunsellan? I asked. He's gone on a binge of conquest recently. It's starting to cause a fuss among the nobility, and that's not the kind of pressure we need right now. I need to know what is truly happening before I can take any action. Go to his domains and find out what the situation is. Meet the man, if you need to, and learn what is on his mind. Simple enough. And I understand the need for subtlety, he agreed. Former ducal court mage, mad with power. Sounds like Oral Pratt, he mused. That's what I'm afraid of, I agreed. He's not a war mage, but he is an adept, and he's got a witchstone. So proceed cautiously. And what credentials will I have to support me? He asked. I went downstairs to my workshop and returned a moment later, handing him a token. That's a Snowstone snowflake, I explained. Rondal made me a bunch of them this winter, before he and Tyndall went off to school, and they are very distinctive, and impossible to forge. I added a few enchantments, too. I can track it, for example, but that should serve as my badge if there is any question. I have to meet with the king and the court in a few weeks. Dunsellan is bound to come up, and I want to be able to say that I have dispatched one of my best men to investigate the matter. And take this, too, I said, putting a few ounces of gold at his elbow, for expenses. As for pay, I'll put you on a monthly stipend for now. Money doesn't interest me, he promised. Problems interest me. I liked Lorcas. I needed more like him.
Chapter 7 The Royal Court. I had expected to be deployed in Gilmora by early summer, but there just wasn't any activity in the penumbra indicating that the Gavani were preparing to move, and logistically speaking, there would have to be. Maybe Shirul was taking the summer off. But if the dead god was taking a holiday from invasion, that didn't mean I could relax. Instead of slaying goblins and dueling dragons, I had been summoned to the royal court in Castabriel. That worked out well, in a way, because I also had urgent business of the arcane orders to attend to, and the headquarters and hub of bureaucracy for such things was in the capital as well. As much as I hated to leave Sevendor in the summer, I was compelled. At least this time I could bring Alia along. She had been nursing the last time I'd come to the capital, but now that Menalion was mostly weaned, she and the baby were both travelling with me, along with a legion of retainers. Alia was bringing both of the children, so Darishi, the nursemaid, was coming, as was her husband and her baby, just to keep up with Menalion. Alia included Sister Bemia as an aide and chaplain. It might have been extravagant to pay for a birth sister to accompany us, but with the new baby, Alia didn't want to take any chances. She also brought along three serving women from the castle to cook and see to our laundry. Saya Kay was in charge of Sevendor in my absence, but I took along Sir Festeran as a personal aide and bodyguard. I also took four of my vassal knights and their squires for security, and a page for running errands. Bannermore was coming. He wanted to attend the convocation and promote the magical fair in the autumn. He also wanted to trade some of his inventory in preparation for the fair, so he brought along a clerk, a porter, and a strongbox. Even Lady Fallowen was coming as an emissary from the Alka Alon Council, and two Tal Alon servants were along to fetch and carry. That was 25 people to make one small journey. I left Dara home. She was at a delicate place in her training. She had learned enough to manifest great power with her small stone, but she had yet to learn control sufficiently to be trusted in public. I had enough going on in the big city without trying to keep up with her. She wasn't a troublemaker, exactly, but she excelled at finding it pre-made and ready to consume. Castabriel was just too rich and interesting an environment, and there were too many hidden dangers that a barely literate girl from the Westwood would not see coming. She wasn't happy about being left behind. Tyndall and Rondal were still away at War College, receiving advanced training, and with Bannermore and the other Magi also heading for the convocation, there wasn't much to do. "You'll have Saya Kay," I pointed out, "and Gareth is acting as deputy spell warden with Bannermore gone, and Master Olmeg should be around. But with everyone else away, I want a native Sevendori noble in residence at the castle, and apart from myself and Alia, you're it. Just don't burn the castle down when I'm away."
"You're building a new one."
"Which won't be ready to live in for years, despite how fast the Karshak are working. Until it is, keep this place standing. That's your primary job as noble in residence. And try to refrain from attempting any serious magic while I'm gone," I advised, as I envisioned the worst. "In fact, just try to read quietly," I decided.
"Read quietly?"
she asked skeptically. "Just little spells," I agreed. She made a face.
"Can I talk to the Alka Alon?"
"Certainly," I agreed. "They won't let you get into trouble, and Tyndall and Rondal will be home soon. Saya Kay can call me on the mirror. And you can always call me mind to mind," I reminded her.
"I'm sure I will not have to,"
she sniffed indignantly. "It would be great if you didn't." I know Saya Kay was in charge. I still was leaving my domain in the hands, technically, of a 14-year-old girl. It made me anxious. The weather was gorgeous as we made our way down the Bontal by barge, chartering a boat for the purpose. The trip was mostly pleasant, if punctuated by business. When war, government, and intelligence can come to you mind to mind, not even the peaceful isolation of a river barge was a refuge. Alia fussed over travelling with the baby for the first time, but Darishi and Sister Bemia were helpful in keeping her calm.
We disembarked at a small village just shy of the capital, and made our way overland by carriage to Pentandra's picturesque country estate of Fair Oaks. She had been there since the Alka Alon Council, tending to the business of the Order and preparing for the convocation. I sent along the bulk of our party to prepare my quarters at the refurbished temple, and Alia and I spent a few days talking with Pentandra and going over the agenda for the convocation.
"This is only the second one, so there isn't a lot of formality yet," she explained over wine after dinner. "But you'll be expected to address each assembly. That is your chance to announce policy changes, give direction, make new appointments, and express your opinions on the class of the mage. Before that, you'll be meeting with the administrative heads of each order to determine exactly what policy changes need to be made. And there are quite a few," she added, in a voice that told me she was understating the problem.
"I can imagine," I sighed. "I've already heard plenty of petitions from people who have snuck into Sevendor, and plenty of written letters begging for judgment or assistance. I refer them to the orders, usually."
"I know,"
Pentandra said miserably. "Which is where they accumulate until you give some direction. It's going to be a few hard days' work." "That will have to wait until after I meet with the King and Queen," I pointed out. "And if I get executed, then this is all in your lap."
"So don't get executed. It would undermine the war effort," she reminded me. "Just find out what he wants and let's get to the important stuff."
I was surprised how well Alia and Pentandra were getting along. Pentandra was a gracious hostess, and they soon fell into a casual, almost sisterly relation. Alia was appropriately complimentary on her recently purchased estate, and did not voice any objections to the presence of so many beautiful young men lingering around. Pentandra cultivated muscular playthings for research purposes, and had no restraint about the practice in a way that would shock most high-born ladies, and quite a few low-born ones as well. Alia was used to her ways, I suppose, or they had come to an understanding. In either case, she did not act threatened by Penny, especially now that we had children together. Women are weird. I couldn't fault Penny's work, however. She had, with the assistance of a team of clerks, organized the Order's affairs as neatly as possible. She was training an assistant to continue the practice in her absence, a monkish mage named Genthiel. But I could not tarry at Fair Oaks long, as good as the holiday did me. Court was meeting, and I had an audience with the king. When most people think of a royal court, they think of a throne room in a long hall with banners and guards and heralds and such. While Castabriel certainly had a magnificent throne room, the actual court usually met in a much more intimate, panelled chamber between the royal residence and the Prime Minister's quarters known as Gilrard's Hall, after a particularly well-esteemed Prime Minister for the Duke of Castile a century ago. Gilrard's Hall is a dark, smoke-filled chamber featuring a large octagonal table around which the business of the duchy, and now the kingdom, was conducted. It was comfortably shabby, a good working environment, but I could tell it no longer suited the fancies of their majesties. The capital had been abuzz about the grand new palace complex that was being planned for a nearby site 20 miles north of the city. The mighty Donrard Spire that had been the seat of Rard's family for generations was no longer adequate for the King of Castleshire. But until that grand new palace was built, we sat in Gilrard's Hall, drank beer and discussed the affairs of the kingdom. Rard looked tired and older than when I last saw him, but he wore his weariness regally. The Queen, on the other hand, was vibrant. She seemed to thrive at being the center of power. As the head of the family, the kingdom's secret intelligence service, she had done a lot to establish that power. When we arrived, I had expected to be greeted by one of her sinister emissaries. Instead, I was welcomed by a senior castellan who showed me to a waiting room outside of Gilrard's Hall. For this visit, I had elected to come with only Sir Festeran to attend me. I was prepared to wait a while, as I usually ended up doing when visiting royalty. But I suppose my stock had risen in the 2 years since I'd first met Duke Rard at Wildhall. I was quickly escorted into the dark, panelled room where the King and Queen, the Prime Minister, the warlord, and other officials were seated around the table. I bowed deeply to the crowns before taking my seat.
"Ah, the spellmonger," Rard clapped. "We were hoping you would be in attendance. We have often missed your wisdom on the affairs of the kingdom."
"On what in particular might I advise you, Your Majesty?" I asked respectfully.
"When are those damn goblins going to attack?" he demanded. "We have troops positioned and more on the way, but they're damned expensive to keep in garrison if we don't need them."
"We need them," I assured him. "Indeed, we need more. From what I understand, the goblins are doing more looting and raiding than conquering. They have yet to cross the river in force. But that does not mean that they are not readying a blow. The longer they wait, the more strength they will have. If we do not have sufficient strength to shield us, then all of Gilmora could be lost."
"So you say," challenged the Queen. "Yet other reports indicated that the goblins lack sufficient supply to venture further afield, and there is some doubt as to their organization."
"They do seem to have pulled back from their advances,"
Count Salgo, the warlord, agreed reluctantly.
"But they continue to harvest our people like wheat in a field. There is no end to the coffles of slaves going northward. 20 times my men have raided and freed the lines of prisoners, but another caravan departs the next day from their captured strongholds."
"And more raiders go forth by night into populated areas,"
reminded a hook-nosed lord with whom I wasn't familiar.
"We've managed to intercept some of them, thanks to your war, Magi Mage Lord, but there seems no end of them. They're using magic, too.
They're avoiding our castles, for the most part, and striking at the few villages that are manned. The cotton harvest will be paltry this year."
"I'm sure that's not the most pressing problem of those people," I pointed out. "I'm sending in as many war magi as I can. We've strengthened the defences on every castle we occupy, as strongly as we are able. But we can't go around goblin-proofing every manor and hamlet in Gilmora."
"But that just sends people streaming into those castles," pointed out Count Salgo. "They're abandoning their fields and posts and forcing the lords to feed them."
"Then put spears in their hands and teach them how to drill," I answered, perhaps a little sternly. "I can help you fight goblins, but I can't make them go away."
"Train the peasants?"
asked Queen Grendine, aghast. "Why not? They'll be fighting for their lives before long anyway," I pointed out, "and every peasant with a spear is an infantryman, not a refugee. You'll have to feed them, but you're feeding them anyway."
"Peasants make poor warriors,"
pointed out a lady on the other side of the table.
"When they don't know how to fight, yes,"
I agreed. "Teach them. If the dead god has decided to take the summer off, then use that time to drill those peasants. They might not be first-line infantry, but they can guard caravans and man a post at a wall if they need to. That will free up your knights for interdiction duties."
"And what happens when the battle is over?"
the lady persisted.
"We have a mass of armed peasants to contend with.
Gilmora is not used to such things," she said. I detected a trace of Gilmoran accent in her speech. "The battle will not be over for some time," I reminded her gently. "Even if we defeated the dead god in the field, he still lurks within the Umbra. He still has the bulk of his armies at his command. When his legions do come, if not this summer, then surely next, then every trained warrior you have will be worth more than 12 cotton-picking peasants." Count Salgo looked at me gratefully. Apparently this had been an argument he had been making and losing.
"We shall see," conceded Her Majesty. "And it is not as if we have had no success in the field. I hear reports daily how our squadrons are attacking raiders and driving them off."
I tried to hide the wince I felt. Those reports glossed over the casualties incurred in those battles. They were frequent, almost daily, and we were winning the majority of them. But mostly we were losing good men piecemeal, men we'd want in good order when the attack did come.
"Can we not face them in the field in strength and drive them from the land?"
asked the hook-nosed lord. I believe he was a deputy minister of finance.
"Not when we're scattered all over, chasing bands of raiders.
If the enemy won't congregate, how can we face them so? Salgo said, shaking his head.
Surely they have taken strongholds?
Asked the lady with the Ramiran accent.
If we take them back, have we not deprived them of their purpose?
So we believed, my lady, Count Salgo agreed. To test that theory, we invested one of their settlements, inside the northern castle frame. Instead of withdrawing inside and hazarding a siege at the approach of our force, which was of a goodly size, they divided their forces and scattered to smaller hamlets and manors prepared ahead. We captured a few score slaves, slew 100 goblins or more, and retook that ruined fort. But we did not slow their take. Another coffle left 3 days later. They will not stand to fight, not against poor odds. Most of our military there are cavalry patrols, and they dislike fighting on foot, at night. Are there no rangers to contend with them? I asked.
Rangers? In Gilmora, a region long settled. Game wardens and foresters, perhaps, but the wars of Gilmora are fought on the field between gentlemen.
Count Moray, one of Rad's closest advisers, observed. Not any more, I observed. If the Gavani will not stand as a large band, then let us send in commandos to root them out, band by band if necessary.
Of what use will that be?
Demanded the Queen. It will deter their purposes, for one thing, I said, ticking off my points on my fingers, which is always to our benefit. It will disrupt their slaving and raiding. It will demonstrate to the people that their king defends them, I reminded them, and it gives them hope. They can gather valuable intelligence on the ground, and that could let us know their plans. And it could stem the flow of prisoners into shadow. Have not the new Royal Commando units been commissioned? I thought they were designed for just such a purpose. Commissioned and officered, admitted Salgo, but still recruiting. But we can find some rangers, I think. The mercenary companies are responding to our bonuses. Many of those men fought in the jungles of Faris, or in the Wilderlands last year. I can probably get some deployed in advance of the commandos. Anyone on the ground, fighting and organizing resistance behind the lines, is going to be helpful. In the meantime, we strengthen the strong points and protect as much of Gilmora as we can. And we rescue as many prisoners as possible. Everyone feeds Sherul's dark purpose, and eventually feeds his soldiers on the field, I said, as convincingly as possible.
What of the Alka Alon?
The ancient Prime Minister, Count Kindine, asked suddenly.
Can they not assist us?
Everyone looked to me expectantly. It was well known that I was an ally of the Tree Folk, and the story of my suddenly appearing embassy was widespread at this point. I'm sure that it had been noted that Lady Fallowen was now in residence in my quarters at the Order. As to that, I began with a deep breath. I have recently been in council with the wise among the Tree Folk. There is much concern among them about the dead god, which they call the Abomination. Enough concern that, with a little encouragement, they agreed to lend us some material aid. More Irionite, I said, earning several surprised looks, and a conditional limited alliance, technical support, assistance in intelligence and such, in return for similar assistance from us, when they require it.
Does that mean warriors in the field?
Asked Salgo, interested. Not many, I admitted. The strength of their alliance will be in their council. But don't discount that wisdom. Without it, we would have lost Cambrian, and Sherul would have one more dragon in his keep. But against Sherul himself, they have little to offer us of yet. They are studying the matter, as is the nature of their race.
Are they not masters of magic?
Asked the Queen, skeptically. I find it difficult to believe that they cannot kill one goblin.
He's already dead, I pointed out. That's part of the problem. You are thinking of him in temporal terms, in how many soldiers he can put in the field. But that is just part of this tapestry of evil we face.
Sherul is powerful, I explained, and he's not even alive. So that limits the ways he's vulnerable. He's essentially a magical construct, based around the pattern of a dead goblin's brain, and he has unfathomable power at his disposal.
He's got access to more power than all of the High Magi put together. You can't stop his heart, you can't blind him, and you can't poison him. He doesn't eat, he doesn't sleep, he's well guarded, and he's aware of everything within the Umbra. So, no, the Alka Alon don't have an easy answer to him, or even a hard one. But that doesn't